Good afternoon. So last time we talked about this idea of pipelining, where we divide our execution of instructions into these stages, and we have one instruction sort of following behind the others, so we have multiple instructions in flight. In the kind of design we showcased in lecture, we had five such stages. And this basically gave us something like a 5x speed up in our instruction execution time by kind of not wasting time when, say, our instruction cache would just be holding the value it just fetched for a long time while we processed it. Instead, we'll have the instruction cache move on to fetching a new value and so on. And we talked about some problems with this idea where it doesn't like just magically give us infinite performance. And one reason for this was that we couldn't just add more and more stages because there was a cost to that. And there were kind of two kinds of costs. One was that we have to buffer values in between our stages. And another is that we couldn't actually split things up into evenly sized stages, and that meant that the longest stage would determine our sort of total execution rate. We also had this issue that, well, I said, oh, we can move on to the next instruction right away after the previous instruction uses, say, the register file, but that wasn't entirely true. We had these control and data hazards, where basically if we did our pipeline naively, we wouldn't have the information needed to correctly execute the instruction. And with control hazards, this information was what instruction do we fetch next? And we had a fix for this, which was this idea of branch prediction, where, well, we're not going to know what instruction to fetch next right away, but we'll make a guess, and if that guess is right, it'll be, you know, as fast as if there was no hazard. If that guess is wrong, we'll take a penalty by undoing instructions. We also had data hazards, where we would read the wrong value of a register. And one solution for both of these hazards was stalling. And for control hazards, we had this faster branch prediction idea. And we had this faster idea for most data hazards of forwarding. That, well, if we have the wrong value, often we've already computed the right value. So we can just send that via a shortcut, not through the register file, but through a bypass path, an extra path that lets us get that value earlier. So questions on things we covered last time before we sort of first talk about a few like loose ends with forwarding and then start talking about something that goes beyond what pipelining can do in executing sort of instructions more efficiently. Okay, not seeing any. So let's consider this situation here. So here I have an instruction, the move, that loads a value from memory and stores it into RBX. And then I have an instruction that reads from RBX and RCX and does a subtraction and stores the result in RCX. And we need to get the value of RBX that is produced by this move. And when do we want that? Well, we want it in time, like here, at the beginning of execute. The problem is that, well, we can't use forwarding alone to solve this problem. That if we wanted that to be by the beginning of execute, this would be kind of when we forward it. But it's not available here because, well, it's computed by the memory stage. We need to access the data cache to figure out what RBX's value should be. So the earliest we can forward it is from the end of memory, but that's too late because we need it earlier than that. We can't subtract on it at the end of the execute stage. There's no time left. And so what we're going to do instead is we're going to stall. We will delay the subtract instruction until we can do the forwarding. So we're not going to do the stalling we do when we only talked about stalling. we delay the subtract instruction all the way until after the move queue wrote the value to the register file. We're still going to use forwarding. We're just going to do it when it's actually possible. And it's not possible right away. We need to wait an extra cycle for that to happen. And in this diagram, I'm assuming that our processor figures out that this is necessary in the decode stage, and that's why the decode stage is repeated instead of the fetch one. But we're figuring out in the code, oh, have to wait. Let me hold back in the decode stage until the value is actually right. So this, you know, means we use some stalling with forwarding, and this is what we'll do to handle those hazards that forwarding alone isn't quite good enough, but it's still a data hazard with a register dependency. Now, here's some similar code where we're going to load a value and then store it. And it might seem like we have the same problem, that we're going to need to stall the second move until after the first move gets the value of RBX. But if we think carefully about what this second move does, well, we don't actually use the value until we access the data cache. So we don't really need the value until the beginning of the memory stage. So forwarding it at the end of the execute stage of the second move, that solves our problem. We don't need any stalling in addition. And this means that if we're implementing forwarding and handling all these cases, we're going to have even more muxes and more wires floating around our processor. But most processors that had a pipeline like this did this because it's worth doing. Because it turns out this is kind of a common assembly pattern, like loading something and storing it somewhere else. So they implement that idea. Now, something you might say is, oh gosh, here we're forwarding from memory to execute. Like, why couldn't we just not stall here and just, you know, forward here? Like, why wouldn't that work? And let's look at the picture of that. We're going to forward from after the data cache until before the memory stage. We could make that wire and install that in our processor. We could add the muxes to choose when to use that path versus the normal one. The problem is that if we do this, our clock cycle needs to be long enough for a value to go through the data cache, get looked up, and then go through the math logic. And if their clock cycle is long enough for that, why did we separate our execute and memory stages in the first place? Because it's long enough to have them all together. We're kind of wasting time doing this. So this is not going to be possible because the assumption is that if we forward from the end of one stage to the beginning of another, we've kind of lost the point of pipelining, which is making that cycle time really low, so we could start instructions very frequently. But with our case of the memory load to store forwarding, right? That's just this path, that's fine. That's not going to be a problem for our cycle time. So that's on some other forwarding. So we talked about forwarding and hazards and some terminology stuff, since there's often confusion about things that are hazards, and we're going to talk later a lot about dependencies. We're going to reason about when we can actually execute instructions at the same time versus not. And there's this related concept that one instruction depends on another. And that's not the same thing as saying we have a hazard from two different instructions. So the hazard is, will something work in a particular pipeline? Versus a dependency just means that there's a relationship between the instructions, like we need to run, have one do its thing before the other one can run. But in some pipelines, that won't be a hazard, depending on the details. So as an example here, we have a bunch of instructions here. If we think of our pipeline, well, if I do a pipeline diagram for this, there, I can see when things actually execute. Now, if I just look at the instructions alone, I know, oh, wait, from RBX in add queue to the RBX in the last add queue, the first to the last, that's a dependency, that we better have the value of RBX from the first add to do the second one. But it's not a hazard because, well, we're going to fetch that first value here, which is after that first add has exited the pipeline. There's no problem that needs any sort of extra work to make that happen. That in our five-stage pipeline, that just works, even though, yes, the instructions depend on each other. It just happened that this dependency didn't require any forwarding or other work. On the other hand, we have this move that moves 100 into RCX, and this add that uses that value of RCX. The move, if we just let it run, is going to forward, going to store the value in this its write back stage, which runs after the add would normally read the value. So that's a hazard. We need to do something to resolve that. It's not a hazard that is going to need us to stall or anything like that, because we can just forward the value from the move's execute stage to the add's decode stage. Similarly, the last two adds have a dependency in that they share R10. So the R10 from the second to last add is used by the last add. So we're going to have another case where we need to forward. No stalling is needed, but it is a hazard we need to do extra work to resolve, which was forwarded. Some questions? Okay. Another thing I'd like to point out about this diagram is that we have this subtract instruction and this move instruction that both use RCX. And they both even write to RCX. But there's no dependency between them, because we can do everything the move instruction needs to do without knowing anything about what the subtract instruction did. They're independent of each other, and this is going to be important later, that we can execute these instructions sort of without them having to worry about each other, you know, as long as we're keeping track of what's the current value of RCX for a future instruction. Yeah. There'd never be an issue with hazards.
In terms of like, so we said that it wouldn't affect anything if we do like a subtraction and a move, but like some of those operations, like a subtraction set certain flags, would there be an issue where like a certain stage in the pipeline overwrites the flags that you're supposed to?
So the question is, for the move and the subtract, we don't have it, they're independent because, you know, one overwrites the other, so we don't care. But what about the flags? Doesn't the subtract set flags that the move doesn't change? You are correct. So if there was an instruction that used flags, we would say, you know, if it was right after the move, it would depend on the subtract, even though, you know, the value the subtract computed other than the flags has gone, you know, is irrelevant at that point otherwise. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So one thing about this notion of hazards is that whether something's a hazard depends on our pipeline. So if we have a five-stage pipeline, then I need to worry that this add here that's in the write-back stage and this and that's in the decode stage need to have the value of R8 sent between them. And I need either my register file to do that or to have a forwarding path that does that. Whereas if I have a four-stage pipeline, like we had on one of the quiz questions, that's not a concern. The add instruction is out of the pipeline. It's completely done. All its values are in the register file. You know, there's no extra work to do. It's not a hazard anymore. So let's do a little exercise here. So let's say we have this pipeline here. We have a pipeline where I've split my execute stage into two pieces. You know, I decided that, you know, execute, the ALU operation took a long time, so I wanted to make it have extra time versus the other stages. And here's some code we're trying to run. Give you a little bit of time to start working this out on your own. We'll start with what goes on line 2. Oh, I did this wrong. Oops. Sorry. Who would like some more time? Okay, so I have prepared explanation. But before that, like a first thing I do in looking at this is I figure out how do these instructions depend on each other? Because that's going to determine where do we need to do stalling or forwarding or something else to resolve a hazard, potentially. And so I know the value of R9 from instruction 1 is read by instruction 2 and is also read by instruction 3. Instruction 3 produces a new value of R9 that is going to be read by instruction 4. Instruction 5 uses R9, but it only writes to it. It doesn't read from it because that's how a move works. A move just copies RCX to R9. So there's no dependency for R9 for instruction 5. So instruction 5 is, you know, doesn't care about what instruction 3 and 1 do to R9. We also have RBX produced by instruction 2, and that value is needed by instruction 4 because we're going to use that to access the data cache. And actually, we're going to do more than that. We're going to use that to add 8 and then access the data cache. So then, as far as figuring out how this executes in our processor, I'm going to sort of fill out my pipeline diagram. So first, I'm going to say, OK, what I'd like to do is I'd like to fetch the second instruction right after the first. So let's try that. And I realize I have this dependency where I need the value of R9 to be available. But R9 is not going to be computed until we're all done with execute. So it's not available until here, until the end of the first adds E2. So that means I need to adjust things. And I'm just going to assume that we're going to delay add queues to code, and that's going to push every other instruction forward in the pipeline, because we can only fetch into code and execute one thing at a time. So I stalled into code. That's when I realized, wait a moment, the value's not available. And after that, I actually forwarded the value. And that executes. So I looked at how I got to instruction 2. And after I did that, everything moved forward. And then I'm going to look at instruction 3. And instruction 3, we need the same value of R9. So I'm going to see, can I forward it? And without adding any additional delays, I already have the fetch duplicated because I couldn't advance to the code yet. I can forward, and that just works because the value is available by cycle 4. So we can send it from memory to decode during cycle 4. Then I look at my move down here, and I have two dependencies. I need to worry about both where R9 is coming from and where RBX is coming from. And it might seem like you might say, okay, well, here's where we normally read the values, and R9, which we know is a dependency, I should do this. Right, this R9 is not produced until here, right? So we have this problem. But remember what we did for the load to use case. We don't have to forward to the decode stage if we don't need the value there. And this is exactly like this case. We're using the value of R9 not to do arithmetic, but to do a memory access. So we don't need it actually until the beginning of the memory stage. And that was already delayed enough that this lines up so we can forward from the add to the memory store. And because the value we're only storing it, we don't need to do any computation on it. We don't need it in the execute stage. On the other hand, the value of RBX, we need to add 8 to it. So that value we're actually going to send earlier, but fortunately it's available earlier, so we can just do that. And then our final instruction I just placed there, because even though it's using R9 and RCX, which have been used by previous instructions, there's no actual dependency. It doesn't care what those earlier instructions in the pipeline that we see here did. It only cares about some much earlier instructions that set RCX. Questions about how I figured out all the pipeline forwarding and delays here? Okay, so that's going to be where we're going to kind of leave off pipelining in advance to going sort of doing more than we can do with pipelining. So pipelining has these limitations where, we sometimes have to stall and we're only, doing one, instructions have to wait behind the stalling instruction. And modern processors have ways of going beyond that. And there's kind of two ideas that we're going to combine together, and we'll talk about how they're implemented. So the first idea is going to be something we'll call multiple issue, that we're going to start more than one instruction per cycle. And kind of the simplest way we can imagine taking our pipeline processor and doing this is that we'll basically make the pipeline really fat, that instead of fitting one instruction at a time, we'll fit several instructions at a time. And if we have pairs of instructions that are independent of each other, this is pretty easy. I say pretty easy, but some things are harder, like we have to do all the forwarding here. We have more things to check for forwarding. And if the instructions aren't independent, well, we need to like delay one and not delay the other to make this work. But this is going to let us, if, you know, potentially run multiple instructions at a time, you know, not just like as far as doing different parts of them, but doing the same part of them at, you know, at a time. And in this diagram showing us doing two at a time, you know, we'll see that kind of modern processors are going to like fetch four or five instructions at a time. But we're not actually going to do just like this, because there's another thing that's going to be a problem if we just do this type of multiple issue. And that's that, well, when we have a stall in the pipeline, we're still having all the instructions, no matter how many we're fetching at once, are waiting behind. And we like to avoid that too. So there's the second idea we're going to use, which is going to be called out-of-order execution. That when we have an instruction stalling, what we're doing now in our pipeline is all the instructions after it have to wait. What we'd like to do instead is, well, there's probably some instructions that we can run right away, because not all instructions depend on each other. So why don't we do them earlier? So that's what we're actually going to do, that we're going to look at our list of available instructions, and when we stall, so for example, I have this move here that needs to wait a while for the data cache. When that happens, what we normally do, we'd say is, well, the instruction after it, it can't keep going because it needs to get the value of R8. And normally in our pipeline, we just not run any more instructions. But what we're doing here instead is we're saying, okay, let's just keep going. This add instruction here, it doesn't care about that move, let's just run it. This XOR, it doesn't care about that move, let's just run it. And we can just find more instructions to run. Now, one issue we're going to discover with this idea is that we still need to make it look like the instructions run in order. And so we'll talk more about what the kind of pipeline stages here represent, but one thing you notice is that we have a beginning part where we kind of get the instructions in order and process them in order, and we have an ending part where we finalize the instructions in order. And the reason we have that step is because we need to handle cases where something goes wrong and we need to, you know, we don't want to finalize the instruction until we know it's really done. So for example, let's say that this load, this move, segfaulted. In that case, we don't want the other instructions to actually get finalized, so that's why in my pipeline diagram, they don't fully finish up until after the move. That we're gonna have some finalization step that we'll be able to see, which we'll call commit, that won't run until we're sure the instruction is actually ready to finish. But all the real work of the instruction will have been done whenever the values were ready. Just this final bookkeeping step will delay until we know it's okay, that the instruction is actually going to finish and should be visible to the program. So we're going to talk more about how we're going to implement this idea combined with multiple issue, which is kind of what our modern laptop and desktop and mobile phone processors were. They don't just use pipelining, they use pipelining with these multiple issue and out of order ideas. And when we're doing that, this is going to require some changes in how we do hazard handling. So this out-of-order execution is going to create problems that are going to make hazard handling a lot less straightforward. And it wasn't straightforward to begin with, right? Figuring out the forwarding is not trivial in our pipelines without out of order. It's going to get way worse with out of order. So we're going to want to have some designs that make it simpler again. Even though we're going to add extra steps to do that, we want to make the computations of forwarding and so on a lot simpler. And this is important because our forwarding has some new problems. So we'll look at some examples later, but in forwarding for normal pipelines, we want to figure out where do I forward a value from and just say, I need R8, where is R8 laid the earliest in the pipeline? Where is it from the most recently fetched instruction? That's a lot less straightforward when we're not running instructions through the pipeline in order, when an instruction that we fetched earlier might be later in the pipeline. That's harder to figure out. We also are going to have a new type of hazard where, because we're doing our write-back stages not in the order they appear in the program, we might end up, if we don't take extra steps, kind of overwriting a newer value with an older one if we compute the older one later. And out of order means we could do that. We're also going to have to do more work to make our branch prediction work, in particular the squashing part. So with pipelines, the squashing for branch misprediction was basically just, we have these things in the pipeline, just forget about them. But with out of order, the instructions might have gone almost all the way done, and we need to kind of clean up what they did somehow. We also have this issue that, like, I'm just saying, oh, we're going to find later instructions to do, as if that's just a trivial little thing to do very fast. And it's not. We're going to want to do some bookkeeping to make it easy to find those instructions to run. So we're going to talk about kind of a high level of how that looks. And to kind of motivate the design we're going to end up using, we're going to go through our first problem here, which was this issue that the value in the last stage might not be up to date. So in our normal pipeline, I have this code here. If I'm thinking about executing this last add, I have two options for R8. And which one do I want? Well, I want the one from the instruction that's later in the program. And where is that in the pipeline? Well, we know that instructions go through fetch, then decode, then execute, then memory, then write back. So the one in write back is older than the one in decode and execute. So we want the one in execute. It's the newer one. In our out of order processor, this logic doesn't work anymore. So we're going to want to do some extra bookkeeping to figure out that the R8 that's in execute right now, that's the R8 that's older than the one in write back. We want to figure out, keep track of how old each of these R8 values we have available to us are, and choose the correct one. And in this case, the correct one is the one that's being written back, not the one that's being added. And kind of the key idea we're going to use to do this is that we're going to explicitly track the different versions of registers. We're not going to say, I'm looking for R8. We're going to say, I'm looking for this particular version of R8. And when we do our forwarding decision, therefore, we're going to say, I want R8 version 17, see where that is in the pipeline. And we're not going to find more than one copy of that because there's only one version of R8 we're looking at. We're not looking at the multiple different ones that are computed. Now, of course, if I want to know which version is which, somehow I have to need to have those annotations in my instructions as I'm passing them through my pipeline. And how we're going to do this is we're going to add a new pipeline stage that preprocesses instructions to annotate them with these version numbers, to indicate, you know, that the instruction's not add R8 and R9, it's add R8 version 7, R9 version 12, and produce R9 version 13. We're going to add those annotations to the instruction. Now, that's going to be some extra work, but that means later on when we do forwarding, that's going to be much easier. So As an example, we're going to rewrite, say, these add instructions. So in this case, we have four different versions of R8, these add instructions use. So our first add takes R10 and a first version of R8 and produces a new second version of R8. My second add takes the second version of R8, which is the one the first add produced, produces a third version of R8, and so on. So we're going to do some preprocessing to rewrite the instructions with these version numbers. And when we're doing forwarding, we're going to make sure the version matches exactly. So when I'm looking to forward to the add R11 R8, I'm going to look to get R8 version 2. I'm not going to accept any other version, and therefore it's not going to matter where in the pipeline everything that's using R8 is. I'm going to be able to find the right one by just comparing numbers. And right now we're using version numbers. We'll see that the actual way we implement this, we're going to use something that's not version numbers, but achieves the same effect. And we'll look at that in detail later in the lecture. So another thing about these multiple versions is that it seems right now that the reason we have multiple versions is that we might have different versions in the pipeline. But we're going to need to store multiple versions more permanently. And to illustrate why, let's look at this example. So this is a write after write hazard. So here, if I don't do anything with this sort of write back setup, I'm going to overwrite the 100 in R8 with this added value of R8. And you might say, okay, so the way we'll solve this is I'll just realize that, oh, I shouldn't overwrite here. But if we do that, we're going to have another problem, which is that this move queue here is not going to be able to read the version of R8 it wants. So what we actually want to do here is store two different versions of R8 in a register file somewhere. And you can see when we're doing this out of order execution, we might need to have multiple versions lying around at the same time because we delayed some instructions that depend on different versions. In this case, the reason that was possible is that we overwrote the value without reading the old one with that move 100. So this is going to mean that we're going to want to have a big register file to store all these versions. So the solution that we're going to use, and that most sort of recent processors that are intended for performance use, is we're going to have tons of extra registers. Like a typical modern x86 processor might have 160-ish per core total registers. And the idea is that each time we have a different version of R8 or something like that, we'll assign it a new one of these registers. So the actual registers we're using, are distinct. There's a different register for each version of a value. And this idea is called register renaming. And this is the big thing we're going to do to make it practical to handle all the hazards in our out-of-order processor, is that because we've done this register renaming, all our detection of how can I find this value to forward and how can I know if an instruction's ready to run is going to be comparing these renamed register numbers. And these register numbers, because they're written to once, and that's that version, and we don't overwrite them, right? We can say, if it's ready, it has this value. Otherwise, if it's not ready, it's not ready. There's no, we have to worry about having, is it the old value or the new value? There's only one possible value for each of these registers while they're in flight. So questions about this register renaming idea? Before we go on to look at a pipeline that's going to be built with register renaming sort of as the key component. Okay, so here, Yes, some terminology. Oh, I have some more slides here. But so some terminology. And when we do registry renaming, I'm going to have some terms I'm going to use. I'm going to call the registers you see in assembly architectural registers. So the registers you see in assembly, they're called architectural because they're part of the instruction set architecture. And we'll call the registers that we actually use, the ones that the renaming renames them to, physical registers. And we're going to see our pipeline, sort of our key idea, is we're going to have a different physical register for each version of an architectural one. So each version of R8 gets its own register. We're going to track for each of these physical registers, is the value ready now or not? And we're going to compare them to those physical register numbers to do forwarding. So let's look at kind of a pipeline diagram for a processor that uses this design. So we've added a few extra stages. Let's go through the stages in order. We can see some stages we've added. So first, we have a fetch stage. And one of the things we need to do in the fetch stage is we need to figure out what to fetch next. And doing multiple issue and out of order actually makes this a bunch more complicated because we need to do branch prediction, and we need to do branch prediction before we've actually looked at the instructions. So we're gonna have some branch prediction logic that's gonna run without even looking at the instructions we're fetching. So you might say, how do we do that? And the basic idea is we're gonna have some tables that are kind of like organized like a cache that store what happened the last time. So if we know we have a jump, we know where to fetch next. And if we don't know we have a jump, well, we're going to make a misprediction and we'll fix it up later. And typically, we're going to have kind of a multi-stage branch predictor because, well, we want to update our predictions once we actually start looking at the instruction. So we'll update the predictions and potentially, like, you know, have a cycle where we fetch stuff that we, and then we undo that and we say, get rid of that, try again. Based on actually looking at the instructions, say, oh, there was a jump there that I didn't know about. And fix that. And in general, our branch prediction becomes much more complicated and much more important because we're fetching so many instructions at once. And I also have a decode stage here. And unlike our pipeline processor we saw before, there is no register read here. This is actually what decode should mean. We're just figuring out what the instruction says, what the separating the fields and all that. And you know, we're going to want a full stage for that here because we're going to decode four instructions in a typical modern processor, not just one at a time. And why four? Well, for this diagram, we can, if we peek ahead, we can run four at a time. So then we're going to have this new pipeline stage that's going to do that pre-processing step. We're going to do our register renaming, and we're also going to do our dispatching. So this register renaming stage, we're going to do the mapping from the assembly register names to the physical ones. And we're also going to dispatch instructions, which means we're going to put them in these queues here. And in the examples we're going to show, we're going to have one big queue, but we might have multiple queues. For example, maybe we'll have a separate queue for floating point versus integer instructions. But this renaming stage is going to set up instructions to go in those queues and do the renaming for them. So that's a new pipeline stage that we're going to add. So then we have this list of instructions that are waiting to run. And we're going to need to figure out when we can actually run them. And so I have this stage labeled issue and register read. So we're going to look at the instructions in the queue and look at which registers have ready values. And we're going to see what instructions can I start now. And we'll call the process of starting an instruction issuing them. And when we do that, we're going to actually read the values for the instruction from the register file. And to support this, we're going to typically have a register file that can do a lot of reads at a time. So like six or more reads at a time. And we're also going to do forwarding here. So sometimes, like, we will take a value, you know, and forward it similar to how we did in our other pipeline processor. I mean, you need to have the logic for that. So then we're going to, once we've figured out the instructions have their values ready, and we can read those values or get them forwarded, then we're going to run them. And we're going to have a bunch of what we'll call execution units, the things that actually run the instruction. And you can see, as we're doing more and more work to run instructions at the same time, less and less of our processor gets devoted to actually doing the work of the instructions. But here's where the actual work happens. And in this design, we have these different execution units that presumably handle different types of instructions. So I have this unit at the bottom that just handles the loads and stores. That's probably where our data cache is. I have several ALUs, and one of them has two stages. So presumably that ALU with two stages handles like more complicated arithmetic, like maybe multiplies. And we have other ones that handle simpler arithmetic. And it's very frequent that we'll split up the work like this. And in the out-of-order design, it's pretty common and relatively simple to have execution units that take different amounts of time. And that's fine because, you know, if we say have something that's doing a divide that takes like 20 cycles, we can run a bunch of other instructions on the other execution units while that's happening. So once they've gone through our execution units, however long that takes, we're going to finally write back the values. So in this case, we have this write back stage that's still attached to our register file. And our register file, in addition to supporting lots of reads at a time, is going to have to support lots of writes at a time. If you want to do multiple instructions per cycle, like you want to like write three or more registers at a time. And finally, we have this commit stage. And this is where we're going to finalize the instructions. This is also where we're going to solve the problem of how do I realize when physical registers can be reused for a new value? That's going to be done in this commit stage. And for finalizing instructions, why do we have this sort of final step for instructions? Like if we've already done all the work and we've written back the value, what's the reason to finalize it? Well, a big part of that is that this is how we're all going to handle things like branch mispredictions or segfaults, where we need to undo work that's gone ahead too far but shouldn't have happened. So with a branch prediction, we predicted the wrong instructions, we started running them, but they shouldn't have happened. We need to undo them. And with like a segfault, like we don't want any of the instructions after the segfault to actually do anything, so we need to undo them. This commit stage is going to have the logic to handle going back to the previous state, and we need to do some bookkeeping for that. And we're going to have this structure we call a reorder buffer that handles that. And you'll notice I have this arrow from the renaming stage into the reorder buffer. So as we preprocess the instructions, we're going to record in the reorder buffer, this is that instruction when it was issued, and we're going to keep them in order in the reorder buffer. And we're only going to commit an instruction when all the instructions before it have committed to. So this means that in this processor, this part is the out-of-order part, sort of as values available. And everything else is going to be in order. And by in order, I mean that this is going to run the instructions in the order they appear in the program. So the only part of the processor that's doing the run instructions as values are available is that sort of middle part after the instruction queue and before the commit stage. The commit stage, we go back to doing things in order, because this is where we want to make sure we finalize the instructions only when we're sure they're supposed to finish, but there's nothing before it that's going to make us change our mind about that. So questions about my big pipeline diagram here?
Yeah.
Since I know this is a very complicated design. So we can visualize what happens, you know, with a pipeline diagram similar to what we've seen before, but now we have a few extra stages. And in this diagram for space on the slides, I'm assuming that we can only fetch two instructions at a time. That's not what a modern desktop processor would do, but it fits much better on the slide. And we're going to fetch instructions in order, and we're also going to decode the instructions in order and do the renaming of the instructions in order. And if we can fetch two at a time, we should be doing two at a time unless we're held back by the instruction queue being full. The instruction queue is full, well, we have to wait. But if it's not full, we can just keep fetching more and more. And after we've done the renaming, remember we're going to put stuff in the instruction queue after the rename step. And we're going to take stuff out of the instruction queue to issue it as their operands already. And this means that the issue happens out of order. That we can see that it's kind of staggered. And if you want to know, like, wait, why does it happen when it happens here? Well, let's look at this add, for example. We have this dependency where it needs the value of R5 from the previous instruction. That means that we can't issue it until we can do a forward the value of R5. And we have some other dependencies, and that's why the issue is staggered like it is. If you look at all the places where we're not issuing right away, it's because the values weren't available. Finally, we're going to commit the instructions in order. So notice that sometimes we have an instruction that's completed writing back its value, but we're not going to commit it yet until the instruction before it has committed. And in this example processor, we're assuming the commit stage can handle two instructions per cycle. So that means even in some cases where we might have more instructions ready to commit, our assumption is that we just don't have the logic to check more than the next two instructions. So there's some limit there where we kind of have to wait a little bit. And maybe if we devoted more resources to making the commit stage, we could fix that. But if we can only fetch two instructions per cycle, it's probably not worth fixing. So questions about instruction execution, this sort of out of order pipeline diagram. So we have these cases where we have these gaps here, you know, and we can say here, like, the instruction is sitting in the queue, and here the instruction is in the reorder buffer. Right. So there's these gaps in the instruction where they're stalled. They're being stored in one of these lists, the reorder buffer or the instruction queue, waiting to be processed. In the case of the instruction queue, waiting for the values to be available. In the case of the reorder buffer, waiting for the instructions before it to finish. So let's go look at register renaming, which I said was going to be kind of our basis for doing all our hazard handling in this design. So I'm going to, for convenience, I'm going to have my architectural registers are going to start with an R, just like in 64-bit x86 assembly. And my physical registers, just to have a name for them, I'm going to name them X and a number. But these are not actually things we can access in assembly. These are things used internally in the processor only. And in the register renaming step, we're going to have to track, you know, what the name of the external register is, what that currently maps to, what the current version is in the physical registers. I also am going to need to allocate new physical registers, because every time we have a new version of a value, you want to store it in a different physical register. So I'm going to have this list of free registers. And when instructions commit, we're going to populate this list. So that's how it doesn't get empty all the time. But this list we're going to need because every time we have a new version, we want a new register for it. So let's go through our example here. So first, I want to rename this add R10 R8. And when I do this renaming, I need to, distinguish between my inputs and my outputs because I have a different version being input than output. So I'm going to have add, I'm going to have a slot for my two inputs and a slot for my output, which I'll explicitly reference. I won't, unlike our original instruction, I'm not going to say input and output, I'm going to have them separated. And for my input R10, I look here, and well, that should be X19. For my input R8, I'm going to look here, that should be X13. And I'm going to write to R8. But whenever I write a new value, I'm going to make a new register for that. So I'm going to assign this register here and make that my new version of R8, and that's going to be my output. So if we're looking at the notation I had earlier, we're basically doing R8 version 1 into R8 version 2. But I've named R8 version 1 X13 and R8 version 2 X18. So that's my first step, and I'm going to keep doing that. So for my next instruction, my inputs are R11, which is X05, and R18. And I'm going to output to the next thing on my free list, which is X20. And I just keep doing this and update my register mapping and my free list as I'm going. Some questions about this register renaming process? So you can see this is a mechanical process, and that's why we can have logic that does it. It's going to be a little trickier than it looks here because we have to rename multiple instructions per cycle, which is going to be annoying, but that's something we'll handle. There's some other complications, and we'll look at this example to illustrate them. So here, let's do some more register renaming. So I have R10 into R8. So R10, that should be X19. And R8 is X13, and we get a new value into X18. So this is the same as our previous example. So then we have this instruction, move from R8 into memory at RAX. And you might say, okay, so the input to this instruction is R8, and the output is RAX. But that's not right, because if we think of what this instruction's doing, we're reading R8 and reading RAX, and we're using R8 and RAX to access memory. So the inputs to this instruction are R8 and RAX, and this instruction's output is to memory, it's not to any register. So I'm going to say we're going to read from R8, X18, current version, and RAX, X04, and write to memory. And I'm just noting I'm writing to memory here just to represent that information. So then I have this instruction here where we access R8 and R11. First, and we'll keep going. But first, some note here. We have this instruction that accesses memory and this instruction that accesses memory. And they're accessing memory at address RAX and address 8 plus R11. And we could get really lucky. And it could be the case that RAX and 8 plus R11 are the same value. In that case, we have a dependency between these instructions. And so far, we've been representing the dependencies by having matching register numbers. But that's not going to work for this memory dependency that is sometimes there, but not always. And this is something the processor obviously needs to deal with. Now, the simplest solution to this problem is that we just run the loads and stores in the order they appear originally. But most processors have found that to be unacceptable for performance, that we really want to load and store things as values become available. And this is why I mentioned that processors do reordering just like compilers do. This is where it's happening. So what they'll do instead is we will compare the addresses and use that to determine when we can do these loads and stores. If the addresses are different, we know we can load the value for the second move, even if we don't have the value to store for the first move. And the processor will actually do that. And this is not going to be registry naming. Typically, we'll have a separate processor structure called a load store queue that handles this comparing and all that logic. And you'll presumably would learn more about that if you took a more advanced architecture course. We're not going to have time to go into how that would work in that much detail. But it is a thing the processor needs to worry about, and this is why when I talked about threading, I said you needed the special instructions to make sure things are available to other threads. This is a reason why, that this is where things will be loaded and stored in an order you don't expect. So then we move on, having worried about that memory. So here I read from x18, and x07 was the previous version of R11. I need a new version, so I'll assign x20 to that and write to there. Then I have my move instruction, and for my move instruction, that's a load, I'm going to have my 8 in my x20, the previous version of R11, I'm going to write to a new version of R11. And I'm noting, just for bookkeeping purposes, that that accesses memory, and the real processor will have some separate thing that handles those hazards. Then I have this instruction that loads 100 into R8. And this instruction has an input of the value 100. It doesn't have any register inputs. And it's going to write a new value. So I'm going to assign that new value, register number 23. I don't have any inputs because I don't care about the old value of R8. I can run this instruction without knowing it. So I'm not going to have it in the renamed version. Then I have my last add of R11, R8. I look up R11 is X21. R8 is X23, and I need a new version of R8, which is X24. So I assign that, update my mapping. And I've renamed all of these instructions. Questions about my register renaming process here? Yeah?
So, when does the processor reclaim the registries?
Question, when does it reclaim it? So that's one of the jobs of this commit stage. So when the instruction's finalized, we know we definitely don't need that value anymore, and we know it because we're committing an order, right? Because all the instructions before it are fully finished. Does that answer your question? I'm skipping a step. We know the previous version is available. So basically the commit stage is gonna say, oh, this is the new version, the previous version is now free, once we've committed the instruction that makes the new version. Does that answer your question? Yes, and I will say for brevity, we're not gonna go into having you simulate that bookkeeping, but there's a lot of bookkeeping going on in these processors, which is why they're incredibly complicated to produce commercially. Other register renaming questions? Okay, so let's finish up by doing this exercise here. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so can someone give me our first instruction here? So this, we're gonna have add Q and what? Yeah. Yes, which we've seen this before. So x13, we look up here. This is x13, it's up there. And r9 is an x17. And we need a new version of r9, which we're gonna take from our free registers. And when we do that, we're also gonna update this table here to note that now, for future instructions, the current version of R9 is X18, not X17. How about our next instruction? What should happen here? The move. Anyone? Yeah.
Move 100 into
X19, like this. Okay, so you said, okay, I need to figure out R10. Here's R10, it's X19, and we have a problem, actually. So the problem, and it's not apparent here because, oh, it looks like nothing else cares about R10, so I can just use that register. But the problem is somewhere before this code, we might have had an instruction that does something, here, like, that was like, you know, add R10 into R11. And when this instruction was renamed, it's using X19. And if we overwrite X19, that instruction's not going to compute the right value sometimes. Only sometimes, because something else is writing X19 too. So in general, we're going to have this rule that whenever we write a value for any reason, even if it kind of looks okay with the instructions we have, which often it will, we don't chance it. We always make a new one. That we're going to rely on whatever fills the free register list to tell us when it's safe to write a value. In no other case are we going to do that. So we're not going to do this, and you know, I'm pointing this out because this is the most common error I see in these exercises is like, oh, I really, you know, we're only using it once. Surely we can use that value. It's not used anywhere else. The problem is we have to think about what about all the instructions that we renamed earlier? What could they be doing? And unless we were doing extra bookkeeping to realize, oh, nothing else is using X19, can't do that. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to say, oh, it's nice that R10 is X19. Too bad I can't use that. And we're going to substitute in a new register. So the other common error I often see here is that some people might say, gosh, the move, like when we did the add instruction, I did value, comma, value, arrow, value. Surely I should be doing that for the move. But no, I shouldn't, because the move, we don't need to read a register. And if I erroneously write move q 100 x19 x20, which you shouldn't write, what I'm saying is we can't run this instruction until x19 is ready. So later on in the pipeline, we're going to check, are the inputs ready? And adding this extra input, even if we don't use it, is going to mess up that check and make us delay this move instruction when we don't need to. Okay, and that was the mean. So that was the mean hard instruction here. So let's go back to our normal instructions. So I want to help me with the next one. Yeah. X20 and what?
13 into 21. Okay. Yeah, so we said R10, well, we just updated it to X20. R8 is X13 still, and now we're going to change that to X21, the next free register. Oh, and I'm out of time. So the other instructions proceed similarly. So we XRQ from X21, comma, X18 into a new version of R9, which is X23. And since I'm definitely out of time, I'll leave the other as an exercise, or you can ask me again. So that's everything for today. So next time we'll talk about the next stage of our pipeline, which is the instruction issue.